Welcome to Better Sex, where you get the information and inspiration to create and enjoy your best possible sex life. Join your host, sex therapist Jessa Zimmerman, as she brings you expert guests, helpful tips, knowledge, and strategies to improve your intimate relationships. And now, your host, Jessa Zimmerman.
Hey, welcome back. It's another episode of the Better Sex Podcast. This is Jessa here to welcome you and thank you for tuning in and spending the time with me. I know there are more and more choices all the time, so I appreciate you being here. Today's episode is talking about sex after loss. I mean, kind of specifically after the loss of your partner, you know, after being widowed. My guest, Krista St. Germain, that's what she does, is work with widowed moms. But it's really a conversation that's bigger than that, too, because it's really about how does sex fit in with grieving at all, right? It doesn't have to be one of the biggest losses you can have, the death of your partner, but really any loss, anything could throw you into grieving and different size things. I mean, there's no judgment. People grieve differently. So something what other people might perceive as a small loss could feel like a big loss to you. But anyway, when you're grieving, how do you discern your needs and wants? How do you decide when you'd like to have sex or when you don't? How do you make those kinds of decisions in a way that is empowering and not fall prey to all the myths that exist? That's what Krista is going to take apart in this episode, is so many of the myths that we have about both grieving and about sex that come together to basically end up just making people feel bad and ashamed and doubt themselves. So that's what we're going to dive into, and I hope you get a ton out of it. And before we start the show today, it is sponsored by Intimacy with Ease. It's a method to help otherwise happy couples achieve a sex life that is easy and fun for both of them, so that you can actually just enjoy your sex life with zero stress. For more information, if you want to watch a brief little training video that's available, all of that, go to intimacywithease.com. So, Krista, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, I know our topic or part of the topic is going to be these 8 myths about sex and grief, and I don't know what they are. So I'm excited to hear them. So you're going to have to track 1 through 8 because I don't have a checklist here. But okay. Where do you want to start with people in terms of what they need to understand about this?
I think kind of the main thing that I run across that's problematic is just any idea that there is a right way or a wrong way, or any reference to stages or any sort of linear journey, right? As it relates to healing. I was just watching, kind of random aside already, but I was just watching a preview for a new show on Netflix. And one of the first things this actor therapist says to the client is, well, do you know what the third stage of grief is, right? I just wanted to reach through the screen.
Yeah.
And punch him, because there's so, you know, we just aren't really well informed when it comes to grief. And so then we layer in sex on top of that, and it just goes from bad to worse.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we think there are, you know, stages or places we're supposed to be, or rights or wrongs, and just all of these foundational misunderstandings that then when we add in the sex bit.
Yeah. Where we're also misinformed, right? In all these expectations,
exactly.
Our expectations get us into trouble. So what you're saying is it's an outdated model to think there are stages and we go from one to the other and never see that one again. Right. Like this is not how it works.
Yeah. And it's outdated to think that there's some sort of timeline that we have to adhere to. And so, you know, that can cause trouble. There's this cultural myth that we have about the first year, right? And what we should or shouldn't do in the first year, as though something magical happens after the first year is over.
Right, and right. So you turn the calendar and all of a sudden, the angels sing or something.
Sing.
Yeah.
They don't sing.
Right.
I was waiting for them to sing and they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are kinds of the basic things, right? Is that it's going to be a unique experience to everyone. And when I'm defining grief, of course, with, you know, the people that I work with, I'm typically talking about, you know, our response to the loss of a spouse, because that's the world that I live in. But grief is so much more than that, right? It's our response to any perceived loss. And so perceived loss is subjective.
Yes.
Our response is subjective. So we really just want to kind of broaden up, when we say grief, what we even mean.
Yeah, it's interesting, because one of the things I talk about with people a lot is really any change involves loss. Yeah. Now, it may not hit you as a big loss. It may not even be something you need to grieve, but really any change in something is a loss of something else. And
yeah.
And then I know that, you know, sometimes people feel bad for having so much struggle over air quotes here, smaller loss, you know, as if there's some sort of scale upon which they're all rated, you know?
Right. And only certain losses qualify.
Yeah. Or only certain ones should really trip you up for a while, or take up a lot of energy for a while, or why are you still worried about that? Or, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we understand that grief is something that never really ends, right? It's just, we have a natural response to a perceived loss. And because that loss is not something we can ever change, then we will always have a response to it. And over time we can change our response, right? We can adapt that life experience and kind of weave it into the fabric of our lives such that it becomes integrated and no longer an obstacle to what we want, right? That's a foundational understanding, because if we think that grief has some sort of endpoint, that when we reach it, then again, you know, the angels sing, or we get to the place where, okay, we're done now, you know, that just doesn't happen. So not only are there no stages or timelines, but there also is no end to grief.
Right.
It's just a part of our life experience. So.
Well, now I'm wishing I had asked you about how you got into this personally and your personal experience and how it relates. So I don't know if you want to speak to that, or if you want to weave that in a little bit here and there as we get to the different myths and how they've manifested in your own life.
Yeah, just give you the Reader's Digest version. So a little over 5 years ago, I was coming back from a trip, and my husband and I had been on that trip together. We'd driven separately. And on the way back from that trip, I had a flat tire, and I pulled over to the side of the highway, and he pulled over behind me to change that flat tire. And as he was trying to get in the trunk of my car to get access to the spare tire, another driver, without braking, nothing, just crashed into the back of his car. And, you know, in less than 24 hours, he was gone. So I went from loving my life. Literally, he was my second husband, kind of the fairy tale romance, you know, man of my dreams. All things were possible at that point in my life. I was 40, to just blanket being ripped out from under me, or rug being ripped out from under me, and thrust into my own grief experience.
Yeah.
Right. And so, so this was not work prior to that point in my time on the planet that I had imagined myself doing. But after doing a lot of work in my own healing, it was the work that I felt called to do. And so now that's what I do, is help other widows figure out how to love their lives again. And part of that is sex.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk specifically about the overlap or the intersection of grief and sex.
Yeah. So, you know, again, different things for different people, but some consistent myths that typically weave throughout, especially if it's spousal loss, right? So one that we hear quite often is, as though we don't know what we want. Well, you know, what you want really isn't sex. What you want really is just a physical connection. And this literally, my clients get this advice from well-meaning people all the time. So, dear, what you really need to do is go get a massage or a facial.
Wow. So people are watching widows or grieving people and thinking,
yeah,
don't do that. That can't possibly be good for you. You just need a massage.
Well, not only can it not be good for you, but you can't be trusted to know what you want.
Wow.
Right? You can't be trusted to know what you want, because really you don't want sex. You just want physical touch. You just want the connection of another human. And so you can meet that need without any sort of sex.
What do you think that's rooted in? I mean, it makes me think of people that don't understand the importance and value of sex in the first place, but you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you're speaking to somebody who lives in the Midwest. And so just watching, you know, how religious, you know, dogma has kind of influenced that, right? That there are a lot of beliefs that pop up in people's own lives, which aren't right, wrong, or good or bad, but they're just an individual's beliefs that, you know, sex should be in the confines of marriage only, or, you know, with someone that is considered your life partner, or holy, or, you know, we just have a lot of rules around sex. And so if we think that another person is about, and we love them, but we think that another person is about to go against what is really best for them, and we believe we know that our rules around sex are best for them, then of course we're going to try to steer them in the direction that we think is best, because that's what we've decided is best for us.
Right. And they must be thinking in the course of this loss, somehow you're not thinking clearly.
You're not thinking clearly.
You're going to thank me later. You're just doing this in some sort of trauma state or something. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so counter that, if you would, with the truth then, which is...
Well, the truth is that you can be trusted to know what you want, right? And what you want isn't wrong. Mm-hmm. And so it's an individual choice that you get to make, right? I'm all for, if you decide, and this is kind of what I did, I decided pretty early on that, I mean, I couldn't even imagine having sex for quite a while after my husband died. It just was so not among my list of priorities or desires. But even at a point, I just decided that's not something I want to worry about. It's not something, it felt like effort to me, right? It just was not something I wanted to deal with. And so if you want to decide that, okay, this is the way that I want to approach sex, and it feels empowering to you to say, I'm not even going to give this any consideration for a particular amount of time, and I'm going to decide what that amount of time is, because I just don't want to give any of my brain or emotional energy to that topic, and that feels empowering to you, right? Then I am all in for that.
Yeah.
But I don't think we do ourselves any service when we start believing this narrative that we can't trust ourselves to know what it is that we actually want.
Yeah. This does raise a question in my mind about, do you, in work with clients around this, do you have any caveats for people? I mean, is there any case or is there anything you see where people are maybe leaping into sex where they're not really tuned into what they want, like where they really are trying to do something else? And, you know, like how would you describe that and help people discern, is this an empowering choice, a really grounded choice, or are they maybe doing something else?
Often what I see is, you know, we try to fill a hole, an emotional hole, an emotional void with sex. And we're not in a place where we realize that we are actually in charge of our own emotional experience, and we're in charge of our own, you know, joy and our own connection, and whatever it is that we're seeking doesn't actually exist in that other person or in that other experience. But when we don't know that, and a lot of us don't, and we didn't even know it in the relationship that we were having, right? We thought that our happiness came from that other person, right? Then of course, when the person gets taken away, but the belief hasn't shifted, or we don't even know it's an optional belief,
right,
then we start going, you know, to dating to find happiness, or to sex to find happiness. So that's what I try to do, is just to help people spot, am I looking to fill a void? Is it like Shel Silverstein's The Missing Piece, where, you know, I think there's something innately missing within me, or there's some sort of emotional experience that I'm incapable of having on my own? And if that's the case, then that's when we want to do the internal work. That's when we want to get ourselves in the place where, if sex is something we want, it's because we want it, not because we're incomplete without it.
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. What's another myth that comes up?
Well, kind of along the same vein, if you want sex, it's just because you're trying to escape your grief. Like, you can't be trusted. And so maybe you do value the connection, but it's because there's something wrong with the way that you're approaching grief, and you want to get away from it, which for some people really is true, right? Sometimes we are trying to escape a negative emotion with behaviors that are, you know, numbing in nature, right? Or distracting in nature. And so you really have to do your own work there. It's not a blanket assumption, I think, that any of us should make, that sex after loss equals escape. But it's a good question to ask yourself, right?
Yeah.
Am I doing this because I want to escape? And do I like my reason? Because even wanting to escape is not right, wrong, or good.
That's what I was just going to ask. It's like, holy cow. So if I get in the hot bath, probably people, no one's going to criticize me for that. Like, I haven't had a loss like this, but I can imagine something about, I would like to live in some space where I can just feel good and happy and connected. You know, there's something about living again, it would seem to me. Tell me if I'm wrong. Yeah. And that this would be one way to do that. So that even this wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing.
Yeah. I just think we want to do it consciously.
Yeah.
Right. So if we're, you know, if we're constantly going to gambling or shopping or something that's more obviously likely to create a net negative impact in our lives, right? So it's a little easier to see that those behaviors maybe aren't the ones that we ultimately want, because for most of us, we don't like the results that they're creating. But that's not necessarily true for sex.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're going to do it as a distraction, A, it's not bad. It's not always a distraction, and just do it consciously. Make that the choice that you want to make, because it aligns with the life that you want for yourself.
Right. And that you're not having negative consequences or impact based on this behavior or this choice.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. What else?
just take me through all the myths.
Yeah.
Okay. So another one I see a lot of, and this can kind of come from outside of us, but can also come from our own beliefs, that wanting sex means that we didn't love our partners enough.
Oh, yeah. Like this person should be irreplaceable.
Yeah. And if we really love them, then we wouldn't even want sex anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which of course I don't think anybody agrees with that really, right? Like it's a human thing to want sex. It's not a commentary on the quality of your relationship, or it has nothing to do with your partner, but it is a common myth and a common thing that I think when we're having our own little doubt about that. And so when we're telling ourselves, ooh, if I do this, then that means I didn't love them enough. Then naturally that's what we project onto other people or see in them, whether or not that's actually what they're thinking. It's what we assume that they're thinking. Right? Because really it's what we are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that small town that you live in is judging you, or maybe, you know, it's you seeing your own judgment in them.
Right. And this seems to me go deeper than just sex. Like there could be a question of like betrayal. I mean, how can I even go on and love someone else, or how long, or, you know, or the question of, is it okay to ever move on and live again? Like, I can't remember what culture is it in Greece where the widows wear black for the whole rest of their lives. Well, and that's like, that's who they are forever.
So we were just talking about that in my master's group, because one of the things that I'm very passionate about is teaching people, not because they have to, but because if they want to, that they can, which is you really can love your life again, right? You can take any loss and decide how you want to respond to it and live a life that's even more aligned with the values that you have and the vision that you have for yourself. And so sometimes even that having nothing to do with sex, right, brings up this fear of disloyalty or abandonment, which is that if I decide to believe that my life can be better in the future than it was in the past, then what does that mean about my person?
Yeah.
Right. Does that mean I'm being disloyal or I'm abandoning them? And
right.
Oftentimes we make that connection when, of course, it doesn't have to mean anything of the sort.
Yeah. And I'm also reminded of, I can't call it a story to mind, but this idea that sometimes people don't want to move on from grieving because it's like a final letting go mm-hmm. of some sort, like living in the suspended state of grieving at least keeps the person
right
near or in your mind or right. Or that there's something about moving on and loving again or sex again or something that might mm-hmm. be a closing a door. Right.
Yeah. I'll see a lot of that even with, sometimes it'll feel like a big kind of, I wanted to say myth, mystery. That's the word I was looking for. Words,
right.
I can find them. So it can seem like a big mystery when even the things that seem little that we can't kind of bring ourselves to do and we wonder why. So I'll see people, you know, really just struggle with like the headstone or struggle with kind of like some sort of finalizing sort of paperwork or something that just really, it's not that big in and of itself, but what it represents is the closing of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And we so desperately don't want that chapter to close or don't want to face the emotions that we think are going to come along with that chapter closing. It's kind of the devil that we know.
Yeah.
And so we just keep dragging it out and postponing those things that would, you know, maybe close it in our mind. And sometimes a new relationship is one of those things, right? Some people, it's the wedding ring.
Yeah. I could imagine that by the time I'm going to go date again or have sex again or have another relationship, that would be closing a chapter, that could be, that could be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we also talked about, you know, another one of the myths is related to this idea, first of all, that there's any sort of timelines around healing. So that a lot of people will say, well, wait until the first year. Sex is only appropriate after you've grieved for at least a year, which is ridiculous.
Wow. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I mean, you know, hey, you can set any timeline that you want to set, but again, nothing magical happens after a year. And I think we've really actually created something that kind of backfires for people, because what I often see is that if you abide by the idea that the first year is the worst, then what often happens is that you kind of grit or grip your way through the first year and you don't really open yourself up to the emotions that you're having and the experience of grieving. And so you just kind of use willpower and tension to get through that first year. And so then as a result, often then the second year is experienced as much harder than the first year.
Partly with this idea that you should have turned some corner and not having done the processing.
Yeah. Right. But really what a lot of us do is, because we're just so intent on getting through the first year, is that we don't even open ourselves up to the emotions that, you know, we're encountering as we go. We just resist, 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 or we avoid, right? We busy ourselves, we distract ourselves. with the intention of just making it through that arbitrary timeline. And then on the other end of it is still all the same emotions that have waited for us. And, you know, they kind of meet up with this misconception that it's supposed to be easier and it's not. And then, you know, a lot of what I hear is like, what the actual, you know, like, this is not what I expected. And so if we could just get rid of that idea in general, I think it would be helpful for healing. And then also, you know, sex, the rules there still apply. Nothing magical after the first year. No divine intervention or spontaneous healing. Right. Angels.
And you're saying basically no timeline at all, whether it's a week, a month, a year, a decade.
I like, never see a value in that ever. Yeah. I really don't. I see a value in, you know, if you aren't able to function with your grief, right? If it is impairing your ability to lead the quality of the life that you want, then by all means, we want to be advocating for our own mental well-being and we want to be seeking help and we want to be figuring out what's in our way so that we can work through it. But when we just judge ourselves and tell ourselves that we should be somewhere other than where we are, that just makes us feel doubt and shame. And that actually prevents us from advocating for our own mental well-being. So I don't find any sort of judgments about time at all helpful. And I'll see women who are a decade or more outside of a loss and really hold up in isolation because of their thoughts about how they should have made progress already. And then they will decide that they're lost causes, right? And they will decide that they don't belong anywhere because of the amount of time that's passed. And so I find that the idea of time passing just really causes a lot more harm than good.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to just take a short little break here, and I want to let you know about Intimacy with Ease, the method that helps otherwise happy couples create a sex life that is fun, easy, light for both people. So if you are an otherwise happy couple, if sex is the elephant in the room or sex is the little bit of the challenge for you guys, you may want to check this out. You can go to intimacywithease.com and you'll see information there. You'll see short videos. You'll have access to a full webinar about it. All kinds of information to let you know if this would be the right thing for you.
Are there other myths you want to make a point to touch on?
So here's another myth that we have, that not wanting sex means that there's something wrong with you.
Well, right? That's what I talk about all the time, you know, so in any situation, but yes.
Yeah, we shouldn't want it. And if we do, we're bad, or we should want it. And if we don't, we're bad.
And is that time related too? If somehow by X amount of years have gone by and you're not back in the game, somehow something's wrong with you? Or is that something?
I think it varies greatly from person to person.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just noticed that we just kind of create these scenarios where we can't win.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And so instead of just allowing ourselves to want what we want and not making that wanting or the lack of wanting mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, we judge. We either want too much or we don't want enough.
Right.
And
neither
one of those things is useful. You know, I didn't want sex for a long time after Hugo died.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I just didn't make it mean that there was something wrong with me.
Yeah. But you could have.
But a lot of people do. Totally could have.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And a lot of people do. And
yeah, I am imagining now, maybe it's just scenes I've seen on movies or something, friends starting to say, hey, get out there. Let me just set you up with a friend. As if enough time has gone by, you should be dating again, or what's wrong with you that you're not back in this world? It's time to move on.
Yeah. And it's so hard to know, right? Because it's such a different experience for each individual. But yeah, more often than not, I think we tend to have people in our lives who want us to get back out there before we tend to be ready. Not always. Sometimes it's the opposite. But then, you know, lots of judgment and shame can accompany that too, where maybe we are, you know, ready faster than other people in our lives think we should be. And they start judging us and we start judging us. And, you know, but neither one of those is helpful. So if we could just lighten up a little bit, right? And let ourselves want what we want and not make it a big deal. If we don't want sex, it's fine. It doesn't mean anything too. I think that's to take it a step further, right? That if I don't want it, that I'm damaged goods, or I'm never going to want it again, or, you know, my one shot is gone, or, you know, I'll never really be happy again. We just take that, the state of our internal desire or lack thereof, and make it mean this whole narrative that it just doesn't have to mean.
Right. As if we're not dealing with enough already, besides all that sort of societally inflicted guilt and shame and doubt.
Yeah, exactly. And then, and we kind of touched on it before, but just this idea that, you know, you should wait until you're not grieving to have sex, which if you buy into the idea that grief has an end, that's
right. There is that implied in there, right? Like eventually you're going to be done, right? And then you're free to have sex. Yeah.
Yeah, predicated on the idea that grief ends. And so if you know it's not golf, right? There's no 18 holes and then we're done, right? It's you're going to have, the loss is always going to be there. So you're always going to have thoughts and feelings about the loss, which means the goal isn't to get over grief, right? The goal is just to adapt to it and bring it with you in your life. Then we can also just get rid of that rule, because that means no sex ever again.
Yeah.
If you have to wait until grief is done.
Right. Is there any particular advice or discussion you have with people about how to navigate sex while you're grieving? I mean, you know, it's you're always grieving, right? You bring it with you, but in the throes of this, like what conversations to have with partners or how to regulate some of this. I'm just wondering if that comes up as a topic or something you deal with.
Yeah. So there's the myths, and then there's also the worries and fears, right? So sometimes I try to address the myths first, to kind of get people in the right mindset there, in terms of, you know, none of what you think you know really does apply, and you get to make your own choices and you don't have to believe any of that garbage, right? And then how do you figure out what you want, right? And what is it that you want? And do you like your reasons for what you want, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think you want to have sex again, but then you realize that your reason is because you just feel a severe hole and you're trying to fill it and you don't like that reason, then we can work on that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But then naturally, if you do decide that you want it, of course you're human. So you're going to have, you know, worries and fears come up. And so then we want to talk about those. Right. So they're not going to, you know, maybe you were with this person for the better part of your life. You know, you're naturally going to be worried. You're not going to like it as much. What if you cry? What if they don't like you like you think they're going to? What if you can never get comfortable? What if you compare them to your, you know, your late partner, right? What if you start and you want to stop? STDs, is that a discussion I have to have now? Like, I've never had that discussion because right, we were together since I was 17, you know,
those
kinds of things. And then we start working on, okay, what are your thoughts about your body? Is it okay for you to want to start and then want to stop? And how do you deal with those things if that happens? And
yeah.
What, is it okay for you to change your mind? So what if you cry? Can you love yourself even if you don't respond in the way that you wanted to? There's never an end.
Did we hit all the myths before I go to another, maybe worry and fear?
When I say 8 myths, I'm just saying those are the ones I see the most. I'm sure there are way more than that.
Right.
So in order for you to have sex again, you have to find the one. Right. For some people, it's more of a rule than a myth, but they have that rule. And so they perceive their other partner to be the one. And so then they put a lot of rules and regulations around the next partner having to be the one, which you can imagine is.
And I would imagine if you come out of a long-term relationship and that's what you've had, is what you thought was going to be a committed life partner, and they die.
Yeah.
It could be a transition to, wait, maybe I just want to date around or have sex with a lot of different people, or, you know, sort of have a different kind of experience than settle down into one monogamous long-term relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that could
and
be.
not a myth, but since you brought it up, it's one of the things that I find does come up a lot, is this idea or this label of being a widow.
Yeah. I had not heard that until you wrote, you know, we were talking about doing this podcast, but
yeah, if you're, you know, if you're ever in a group of widows or you're in a, you know, Facebook group where there's a lot of widows or widowers hanging out, a lot of them will talk about going through their widow stage.
And they even self-label that, not like this
is self-label.
Wow.
Yeah. My thoughts about that label, I'm not a fan of it.
Yeah.
I think we can have multiple sexual partners without calling ourselves hoes.
Right.
But also I understand that when some people use it, they find it very empowering and very liberating.
Right. Because they've chosen that themselves. It's not derogatory. It's just like, this is
playful
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so do whatever works for you, but for sure, if you were, it's not always just because, but often when I see it, you know, it's someone who was in a long-term relationship and maybe it was the only long-term relationship they've ever had, or they never really did date around or, you know, have sex with any partners as they want to. And so they do see this as an opportunity, right? And I think you can do that in a way that is empowering without calling yourself names, but hey,
yeah,
you know, if you feel okay with that name, it feels empowering to you. All right.
Yeah. Like you keep saying, check in with your own gut. How do you feel about this? What do you want in terms of language and behavior? Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then the other myth that I see a lot is that you're not ready until you don't have strong emotions about it. Right. You're like, you'll know you're ready because you won't have strong emotions.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's sort of heartbreaking.
It's really unrealistic.
Yeah.
It kind of presupposes you're a robot or something. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Like, when are you not going to have strong emotions? I mean, I guess what's strong, but you know.
And what is it about having strong emotions that we equate to bad?
Yeah, danger or unbalanced.
Why would the goal ever be, to not have strong emotions?
Yeah.
I say that and I'm like, still trying to figure it out myself. But yeah, as though we're just supposed to be kind of solid. I think we just need to give ourselves permission, you know, for it to ebb and flow. And it's totally okay to be really interested and then decide that we're not, or to decide that we're not, and then decide that we are, or, you know, to be scared, to be anxious, to be confident, you know, whatever it is, it's all okay. And it doesn't mean you aren't ready, and it doesn't mean you're stuck, and it doesn't mean anything unless you, other than you're human.
Right. Yeah. Which strikes me as so much of this is, you know, you're ready when, don't, you know, this is the right time to have sex again. And that, first of all, a lot of this is externally imposed. Mm-hmm. And arbitrary, you know.
Yeah.
But even some of this about your internal state of emotions, it's like, no, this is all misguided. So,
right. So
just, I guess, sum this together a little bit. How do you talk to people about how they know that they're ready? It's an individual person.
Yeah, it's an individual decision, right? So you can use it as an escaping sort of mechanism if you want, but just make sure you like your reason for that. Right.
Know your reason, and like your reason.
Yeah. And decide to believe that you can trust yourself to know when you're ready.
Yeah.
That when you're ready has nothing to do with what your mother or sister or mother-in-law or anyone else in your world thinks, right? That you know when you're ready.
Yeah.
And the only person who knows is you, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you're not nervous or scared or have some apprehension or worry or fear around it, right? But you're open to it. If I can get people in a place where they know that they can be kind to themselves on the other side of whatever decision that they've made, right? So let's say you do go into it and then later you decide it wasn't what you wanted. Can you be kind to yourself on the other side of that?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the strongest and I think most empowering place to be, right? Is to say, listen, I can love myself as a flawed, imperfect human. You know, I may not always do what it is that I wish in hindsight that I did. But on the other side of that, I'm not going to be mean to myself.
Yeah, right.
Right. I'm going to learn from it. I'm going to figure out what worked for me there, what didn't, what's aligned with the life that I want. And I'm going to bring that lesson forward and I'm not going to be unkind.
Yeah.
And then with that foundation of self-trust, we can have a whole different experience when we have sex again.
Right. So talk a little bit about where people can find you, what you've got available in terms of resources or.
My favorite thing, as probably yours, is podcasting, right? So I have a podcast. I love podcasting too. It's called The Widowed Mom Podcast. And it is very niched, but I would say anyone who's interested in grief in general or post-traumatic growth might love the podcast. So you can definitely check that out. Or coachingwithkrista.com is my website. It has all my connections. I like Instagram, Facebook. I do a lot of Facebook Lives, do little trainings here and there. So they can connect with me there. But primarily what I do in terms of if somebody wanted to work with me is I work specifically with widowed moms, right?
Yeah.
I am specifically helping them love life again. And my hope is that the work that I do for them also flows into the rest of the world and helps other people who aren't widowed moms too, you know?
Of course it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the least of which are their children, right? So
truth, right? Yeah. That I always tell people to watch, you probably feel this way too, just to watch the ripple effect of what you do when you're helping a person. And then you watch them either change in a way that role models something to their children or pass along a tangible skill that they've learned to their children. Oh, that's like the ultimate for me.
Yeah, me too. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Totally my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Better Sex. Please visit our website, bettersexpodcast.com, for show notes and additional episodes.
And that's a wrap for today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are enjoying the podcast, if some of this material resonates with you and you would like to make a difference and make sure that this keeps coming out in the world once a week, ongoing, there are a couple things you could do to show your appreciation. The first would be to go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That really helps us be found by new listeners when you review the show on iTunes. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/iTunes. The other thing I want to invite you to consider is becoming a Patreon. For a small monthly pledge, you get some benefits. So for $2 a month, you get advance access to every single episode. For $5 a month, you get a chapter of my upcoming new book. And for $10 a month, I host quarterly get to know you and question and answer chats over the web, and you get invited to that. I would love to have your membership in that. Become part of the Better Sex family. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/Patreon, which is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Again, thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here. Feel free to comment, ask questions, get in touch. I'd love to hear from listeners. Thanks.